Hey, everybody. Movie retrospective time.
Yeah.
Here is a movie that I am amazed that Tom has never seen.
I've never seen this fucking
had
movie.
Had never seen.
Never seen it.
It's just amazing to me. Yeah, it's amazing to me that you had never seen it.
Fight Club is not a good movie. Fight Club is a fucking great movie.
Well, of course it is. Everybody knows that.
I've been hearing about it, you know, off and on for a long time, but I never had a chance to see it. Just never got around to it. And it was not what I thought it was. It's not what I expected. It's fucking pretty cool. Deep. Got some weird twists and shit.
Yeah.
And they called a lot of stuff right about humans and human nature. And I didn't see it coming as it was starting to unfold. It was badass. Very badass.
It's interesting because, so even though the first two rules of Fight Club are you're not supposed to talk about Fight Club, we're talking about Fight Club.
Yeah.
So this is came out in 1999, obviously, directed by the awesome David Fincher.
Yeah.
Who has made so many good movies, you guys. Fucking Zodiac, Seven. He worked on Mindhunter, the TV series. He did Gone Girl. He's done like so many fucking classic movies.
Yeah.
And this is definitely one of them. Now, this was based on the novel by Chuck Palahniuk, who this was his first novel, I think. I read it a long time ago. I think the novel came out in 1996.
I don't know this guy's background, but whatever influenced him, he was right on about military cults and what a warrior cult is. That's what this is about. And you know, if you're not a regular to the show, you know, I've had a good military career and a paramilitary career working for law enforcement type stuff in support roles, but coming out of the 101st Airborne Division, 1st 327 Recon, 1st 506 Infantry, up on a DMZ in Korea, fucking some operations in the Middle East, I'm very familiar with warrior cults. The army is a huge warrior cult, and I was like out of some of the cultiest of the cult warrior cults. Just fucking Google 1/327 Recon Platoon. And we're in there, man. Fucking hell yeah, this is what a warrior cult is. And I didn't see this movie coming. It started slowly, and then I realized that as the story unfolds, all this shit's happening to serve a bigger purpose. And things aren't as they seem. At the end, you're like, oh, okay. All right. I don't know if I want to. I guess we can spoil the twist eventually.
Everybody has seen this movie, except you.
Except me.
And everybody knows what the twist is.
Yeah. This dude's mentor that's fucking teaching him to be a badass, you find out that it's his alter ego, that he's talking to himself. Kind of like something out of Venom. It's very much like, you pussy. You know, like, he's got this inner demon that fucking drives him to fucking more and more, higher and higher heights. You know, in terms of fucking physical performance and combat effectiveness, you know, to destroy a bunch of fucking banks, you know, it's terrorism, basically, economic terrorism. And he's fucking created a huge warrior cult to support him. And it just happened without him knowing that he did it. He thought this other guy did it. It's badass. It's a good flick.
Well, there have been.
He's kind of like a Batman villain.
Kind of.
Yeah, he's kind of like a Batman villain.
It's interesting because, I mean, there have been dissertations written on this movie, okay? This is one of those, movies that, and you see this a lot with these kind of movies that become like huge cultural phenomenons like later on. When this came out in 1999, it didn't do all that well. Like, it did okay, but not as well. And the studio executives didn't really like it. I don't think they knew how to market it. In 1999, I think that the marketing, you know, what I can remember of it, it kind of focused just more on the fighting, but that's not really what the movie is about. And I don't really think that they knew how to approach it. And, I don't know if it was just the marketing or just people weren't ready for it at the time or people didn't get it, or I'm not really sure like what the problem was, but when it came out in the theaters, it didn't do all that well. It kind of got, you know, a mixed critical response.
People didn't get it, I don't think.
Yeah, it might have been that. But then, like, when it came out on DVD and stuff like that, it started picking up, like, a massive cult following in a lot of the same way that stuff like, you know, Office Space or Idiocracy or something like that, where, you know, it didn't really do that well in the theater. But then, like, when people started seeing it, there was, like, a huge word of mouth thing. And soon, like I said, everybody, that's why I was amazed that you had never seen Fight Club, because it's so penetrated into American culture that I'm always like surprised when people haven't seen it.
Yeah.
Just because.
Well, as you would think that, well, Fight Club's just about some dudes fighting in a club. No, not really.
It's not. That's not really what it's about.
Yeah.
I mean, that is in there. It is violent and stuff like that, but that's not really what the movie is
talking
about.
It's about this dude who's got a split personality and his, I guess you could say, his dark side alter ego is driving him to do all this stuff. And one of the things that they do is that he's bringing people into this warrior cult and he's toughening them all up. He even recruits from all these self-help groups and everything. But he's doing it subconsciously, kind of under the direction of this higher ego that he has, a superego. And this superego is like better than him, better looking than him, more funny, more sexually fucking aggressive. He's everything he wishes to be. He thinks it's his sensei, basically, or his platoon sergeant or his friend or something. No, it's him. He doesn't realize it, you know. But he builds a damn warrior cult out of this fucking underground fighting club. It has a bigger purpose. It's just to get them to teach them. They slowly turn into a damn warrior cult where they're honoring the fallen dead and fucking doing all kinds of stuff. And they're ready to sacrifice their lives for a bigger cause. It's a lot like kind of some of the Batman villains are being shown as, but this one explains how you do it. It's almost like a how-to manual. And having personal experience, everything shown in this movie would work. That's the way people are under those conditions. You just have to find the right ones.
Yeah, I kind of feel like the interesting thing, and like I said, there are several different, I guess, interpretations of this movie if you really want to go. I don't know if interpretations are there, because I think it's pretty straightforward, but I mean, there are different, like, angles you can come at it, you know?
Yeah.
You know, a lot of people have said, I think a lot of people resonated with the first half of the movie as a critique of capitalism, you know, or this kind of mindless consumerism is probably the better thing.
Yeah, empty consumerism.
Empty consumerism.
People don't have any warrior spirit to them, no spirit. They just buy shit and then they die and they're forgotten. That's what this is, a very Nietzschean of rising out of the morass is what they're talking about. Escaping the wheel of suffering.
And I mean, it's a very Generation X movie, which Chuck Palahniuk is Generation X. Brad Pitt is as well, I think. So it's getting into that whole, and I think even Brad Pitt has a line in the movie where he calls this the middle children of history. Like, we didn't have a war, we didn't have anything, like no cause to fight for, and now it's just like this empty consumerism.
Yeah.
So the narrator, played by Edward Norton, who is never given a name, he doesn't actually have a name through the first half of the movie. He's just, you know, he goes by different, you know, weird names, like when he goes to the different groups and stuff, but he doesn't have an actual name.
Yeah. If the movie is a critique of capitalism, I'm going to agree with that. It is a critique of capitalism, but not as an economic system, more as a spiritual system. Capitalism has given you the comforts that you need to become weak. You have to strip those away so you become harder. That's what they're talking about. Capitalism has made you weak and comfortable, seeking pleasure. That's exactly what that's part of the thing. Because that's what, remember, he strips out of those people. It gets them to enjoy pain and suffering to make them stronger. That's that which does not kill you makes you stronger. Very Nietzschean idea. So it is. That's part of it. But it's also self-actualization through this warrior cult destroying enemies. And, you know, and having your ideology take over the other ideologies to become dominant. It's the achievement of dominance in the end. That's how I interpreted it. Even though there was a mental illness there.
Yeah, no, yeah. Well, okay, so how I interpreted the movie, you know, like I said, I kind of feel like most people know what happens in this movie. You know, you have narrator played by Edward Norton. He has this sort of empty existence. He has an office job that he hates, and he can't really, you know, he just kind of decorates his apartment with all this IKEA furniture, and he can't really feel anything. So he's kind of, and he's suffering from insomnia, and so he starts going to these self-help groups of diseases that he doesn't have, like testicular cancer and things like that, because he finds that that's the only way he can get any sleep, by, like, releasing some emotions. Because, like I said, he's kind of become an emotionless sort of drone in our consumerist society or whatever. Now, a catalyzing event happens when he meets Marla, played by Helena Bonham Carter, who is doing essentially the same shit that he's doing, like being a tourist to all of these groups, but she's much more like ballsy and brass, you know, out front about it.
And she's a cute young goth girl, goth type chick in this stage in her career. She's what? Maybe 30?
I have no idea.
Okay.
But yeah, so she's like a lot more unapologetic about it. And she clearly has some mental problems as well, but they kind of have a connection. But he gets pissed off about it because he's like, well, you're here and you're like proud of being fake. Like, she goes to testicular cancer groups, which fun. Obviously she doesn't have. You know what I mean? And she just like daring people to call her out on it, and nobody does. So Edward Norton is like, well, I can't, you know, get into the emotional release of these groups if you're here, because I know that you're faking. So they have to come up with this some kind of thing where, you know, well, I'll go on these days and you go on these days and blah, blah, blah. Now, shortly after he meets her, which is significant timing, he supposedly meets Tyler Durden, played by Brad Pitt, on an airplane. Now, Tyler Durden says that he's a soap salesman. And that he basically gives a little bit of a philosophical, but yeah, like, he's everything that Edward Norton, I guess, wishes he was. You know, he's very handsome, he's very, you know, outgoing, he's very, you know, like you said, like, sexually aggressive.
Well, he's fucking Brad Pitt.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, and he also kind of tends toward a sort of, like, hey, man, what's, like, free, chaotic kind of energy.
Yeah. I also gotta say that Brad Pitt is fucking in great fucking physical condition in this movie. He's fucking at his tip top.
Well, they train.
Motherfuckers cut, man.
They train both Brad Pitt and Edward Norton in like all mixed martial arts. They did all that kind of stuff like before they did this movie.
Brad looks fucking cut as fuck in this.
He does look really good in this movie. Yeah.
Yeah.
But, you know, and they did do, even though the fight scenes were choreographed, they said that they actually did say, hey, just like wail on the people, you know what I mean? Because they wanted it to look as realistic as possible. So he meets Tyler Durden, and Tyler Durden it's interesting because at first, it seems like Tyler Durden is like helping out, because he's just kind of like, well, you know, you're too buttoned up or you're too worried about your consumerist, whatever. They end up living together after Edward Norton's apartment mysteriously explodes. So he ends up living in this ramshackle old house with Tyler Durden, and there kind of becomes like a love triangle thing between the two of them and Marla, you know, where Tyler Durden is just like fucking the shit out of Marla, and, you know, and like the narrator is getting all pissed off about it and everything.
Fucking all beaten down in this fucking bombed out old fucking house, and he's fucking banging away on this chick that he likes, you know what I mean? And it's funny. She comes down, you know, fucking, and then she's trying to talk to him, and fucking he's, what are you, and he kind of turns on her. And fucking his boys keep to get her out of here. Get her out of here. And he don't tell him. Don't even, you know, don't talk to her about me. That kind of shit is another thing. And he's got to kick her out, which is funny because you don't know it at the time you watch the movie, is that from her point of view, she doesn't see two dudes. She sees one. The other guy's telling him to kick her out. And he's feel all cucked out. He cucked out over himself.
Well, I mean, from her point of view, he just seems
exactly
like
psycho.
Schizo.
Yeah.
Right.
From his point of view, there's another dude in the house who's banging her.
But that's what, and like I said, I think that it was really good, like, the way it was set up.
Yeah.
Because it actually does seem like there's two people.
Yeah.
But knowing the twist, when you go back and watch it again the second time, it will become very clear to you that when Edward Norton and Brad Pitt are having discussions, it's usually not in front of other people, or there's always some kind of, you know, plausible deniability as to how that dude is not there.
He's got that same thing that fucking Jack Torrance and fucking Venom and fucking I have. There's somebody else talking to you. He's got that same thing.
Yeah, but to everyone else's point of view, it just looks like he's either punching himself in the face or he's talking to himself or something like that, because
now,
he sees another person.
I knew something was up because there's a couple times in the movie where he turns and looks at something and you can see the flash of a person standing
there. Yeah, there are single frames of Brad Pitt prior to his introduction to the film. I believe there are four of them.
Yeah.
Because, and that ties back to one of Tyler's things is one of his, you know, agent of chaos type things, is that he likes to take a single frame of porn and splice it into the like movies. A family movie, like when all the kids are there. So it's like they're, and so, you know, Edward Norton even turns to the camera and says, you know, they don't know they saw it, but they saw it.
Yeah.
And interesting at the, so there's like single frame flashes of Tyler Durden, if you didn't notice. And there's also right before the end credits, I think there's also a single frame of porn. Yeah. I think it's like a flaccid dick or something.
Yeah.
That you can see like right before the credits.
So when I saw a couple of those flashes in the movie, I realized that either something's not right with the reality we're being shown.
Yeah, that's a hint that he's not a real person.
Right.
And it's like I said, it's instructive that Tyler Durden doesn't appear in Edward Norton's life until after he meets Marla. Because the thing about Edward Norton's character is that he has emotionally shut off, right? Yeah. And so he is unable to deal with his feelings toward Marla, and he feels perhaps inadequate or, you know, whatever it is. So that's kind of like the catalyzing agent for him to, like, come out with this other personality that has all these things that he wants to be, or that he perceives that she wants. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So that's kind of where all of that is coming from. Now, after a time, though, Tyler starts getting a little bit out of Edward Norton's control, in the sense that Edward Norton is still having this really bad insomnia, which is not insomnia because it's just he's going and doing Tyler Durden shit while he's supposed to be sleeping, so he's not actually sleeping, even though he thinks that he is. So Tyler Durden is essentially... he starts out kind of small, just doing kind of like funny shit, like, oh, let's go in Blockbuster and erase all the videotapes, you know, with the big magnet, you know, just little stupid shit like that, or those funny ass things they put in the airplanes with like all the people going, ah, like with the flames, like killing everybody, because, you know, there was a scene of them like talking about shit on the airplanes and the little safety cards. So doing shit like that. But as the movie goes on, the shit slowly starts to ramp up and ramp up. To a point where Brad Pitt has pretty much recruited, like, an army and is doing, like, some terrorist shit.
Yeah. And it seems pointless. It's not political.
Yeah, it's... Yeah. Well, the thing about it is that, it, you know, in aggregate, he's supposed to be... I guess he's kind of like the Joker. He's, like, an agent of chaos.
Yep.
I mean, he's not a good guy, obviously, but you can understand how someone would think of it, because everybody can relate to like having a shitty job or having a shitty boss or having like feeling like you don't have any purpose in life or feeling like disconnected from your emotions. Everybody can deal with that, you know, or everybody can relate to that.
Yeah. You saying that he was like the Joker is probably why I thought that he was like a Batman villain.
Yeah.
Because he does the same thing that the Joker does. The Joker burned a whole pile of money. He didn't need the money.
Yeah.
It had nothing to do with it. And that's what he's doing. He's destroying a whole block of fucking office buildings because he doesn't need money. He's beyond that. Money and working shit jobs made him fucking immune to it. He didn't give a fuck. He was more about just self-growth and actualization and achieving dominance over a system that he saw that was oppressing his natural humanistic urges, I guess would be a good way to put it.
But the irony of the film is that as the terroristic activities get more and more elaborate, and as he actually has gotten to a point where he's formed essentially a paramilitary unit, the irony of it is that he has become the very thing that he was rebelling against at the beginning.
Well, it's the cycle.
Right. At the beginning, he was just like, you know, I don't even have a name. It's like I'm just this nameless drone that does whatever I'm told. We all do whatever we're told. And then as the movie goes on, you know, this...
He becomes that.
He becomes that. Because obviously, you know, the paramilitary group that he forms, they all wear the same thing. They always do exactly what they're told without being questioned. None of them have names until, you know,
until they die. Right.
And it's things like that. So, like I said, that's kind of the irony of the whole film. And that's kind of one thing that, because I feel like when this first came out, it seemed like it was really popular with, like, teenagers. And I think that they related, like I said, to the sort of, like, anti-consumerist type of thing, which is in the movie. But I don't know if they failed to realize that you know, in doing this quote-unquote chaotic sort of thing, like, he ended up pretty much in the exact same place that he started.
I guess how some people might see that as irony. To me, I just see it as the system, that's how it is. It's a cycle.
Well, right, I know that, but I'm just saying that ironic in the sense that I don't know if original audiences might have picked up on that, or maybe a younger audience didn't pick up on
it. It goes back to Nietzsche. Everything that exists imposes on something else. There's no way not to impose. Animals feed on other animals. Men feed on the animals. The animals feed on the grass. The grass competes with each other. The grass are competing each other for nutrients and even light. Even inanimate objects fuck over other inanimate objects by occupying space that another object could occupy. There is no way to exist without dominating. So it's him getting into the system and taking the role of the thing that was, of the system that was oppressing him. It's just part of it, and replacing it to achieve dominance. But that's never forever. He ends up being replaced, because eventually time, again, you can't win forever. But that's just the cycle. That's how I interpret it.
And honestly, the end of the movie is a little bit different than the end of the book. I think in the end of the book, the narrator ends up in, like, after he realizes that Tyler Durden is a, you know, projection of his id, if you were whatever, if you want to call it
super
that.
Super ego and id combined.
You know, after he realizes that, I think he ends up in an asylum.
Yeah.
But at the end of the movie, he actually starts to fight back against Tyler Durden's, you know, philosophy, if you want to call it that, just because he realizes this is going the same way that, you know, what I was fighting against from the beginning, you know, and he kind of finds his humanity again in the sense that he's actually able to care about Robert Bitch Tits Paulson when he gets killed, which is Meatloaf. When he gets killed, he actually cares about that. He cares about the woman in the cancer group, Chloe, and he actually, like, asks Marla and is able to tell Marla that he really likes her and he cares about her. He doesn't want anything to happen to her. So it seems that at the end, even though all the shit does blow up at the end, and he does shoot himself in the face in order to kill the Tyler Durden part of himself, but he does live.
Yeah.
So the implication being that he's, even though obviously he couldn't stop Project Mayhem, the shit that he started, he's now come to a place where he understands that there has to be, like, some kind of balance between the things.
Yeah. No, you got, also, you have to there's an alternate interpretation. If you noticed him in his normal self trying to stop the plan, and every time he did that, he actually forwarded it more.
Well, because in his Tyler Durden thing, he said, I'm going to say this.
Right.
You know.
And him caring about bitch tits, all right, is what gave them the idea to fucking sacrifice their lives. So, don't you remember that? Oh, now they added to the warrior mythos of that dying in a selfless act, which is, that's what the militaries are all about. Dying in a selfish act gives you immortality in the minds of the other cult members. It's kind of like, it's religious. It's like, you know, going up to heaven or returning to Valhalla. That's basically what it is. So without him caring about it, the group probably wouldn't have worked. So no matter what he did, he was helping.
He didn't realize prior to that he was working at cross purposes to himself, because it was almost kind of like I said, he was essentially a split personality. So one was saying, well, he was talking about out both sides of his mouth without realizing, because he thought that he was a separate person.
Another thing is that Nietzsche would say to not be in that eternal struggle of trying to achieve an amount of dominance would be to do what a lot of Buddhists did, which is meant would be to try to become above something or to try to withdraw from the conflicts of life. And in the Nietzschean sense, that makes you a loser, the worst kind of man. So in a way, this idea of trying to stop this big attack or trying to renormalize things and make everybody friendly and normal again would be an abomination from a Nietzschean point of view. And even his lesser self was set up by his superior self, if that's what you want, to, even when he tried to foil it, it was set up already that he actually just improved it. And I think it's also talked about, which may be like they're talking about the duality of man, that it's inescapable. You know what I mean? That it's inescapable. That even if you're a loser, in a way, you're kind of empowering winners. Even if it's within yourself. That's how I interpreted it. But that's Nietzsche and Schopenhauer. And Buddhism, you know. You're not moralizing in a normal sense. It's just what worked and what happened. And since he achieved the mission, that confirms everything I guess you could say his darker self, it confirmed that. It won. You know?
Yeah.
He couldn't stop it.
Well, yeah, because, he didn't realize until too late what was
now,
going on.
Now, in that philosophy, that victory is only temporary. Because in the nature of the universe, you're replaced, just like everything else. It's a cycle. So he was probably replaced. He probably went to the lunatic asylum or went to prison. Because the cops knew who he was.
Well, yeah. Well, the cops were already beginning to suspect that he had actually blown up his own apartment, which he had, even though he didn't realize it. So they were closing in on him. I mean, they called and said, hey, we need you to come down here, because they had figured out that he had blown up his own apartment.
Yeah.
In real life, he's not going to escape.
No, it was like a suicide attack in a certain way. It was just... him achieving dominance over what he saw as an oppressive enemy, which were those bags. That's what all it was. And he was ready to give his own life to get it done. That falls right into Nietzsche. Nietzsche says it's better to die believing, and it's better to die fighting for what you believe in and go down in a hail of bullets than it is to live as a slave or a loser in the face of an enemy. So it's like a death before dishonor. Kamikaze mentality. That choosing life is failure in that sense of the word, in that situation.
A lot of stuff in this movie too about fear of emasculation. Particularly with this testicular cancer group, they don't have any balls, and Meatloaf having bitch tits and him being like a woman.
Blonde guy, too pretty. Had to destroy somebody who was too good.
Yeah, had to destroy something
all that
beautiful.
Stuff, all that
There's
was
a lot
there.
Of that kind of stuff in there. Yeah. And also a lot of homoeroticism, gotta say.
Yep.
Which probably not surprising, because Chuck Palahniuk, the novelist, is gay himself. So it's not...
Not homoeroticism per se, it's not bromances.
Well, it's not super overt, but there's some scenes in there.
There's undertones.
Yeah, there's definitely some lines in there that could definitely be interpreted.
It's like sexual hierarchy between dominance and who's the bitch and who's the man. That type of shit.
I mean, that whole scene with where Edward Norton is in the bathroom and then Brad Pitt is in the tub.
Yeah.
And then Brad Pitt saying something like, we're a generation of men raised by women. Do we really think more women is the answer to this?
Right, yeah.
Hyper-masculinity. Right. So it's kind of like this whole... So that's what I meant by homoeroticism. And like I said, there have been whole papers written about this movie in that context as
well. Leather daddyism.
Yeah,
which that flows right into what I was saying before about these Nietzschean warrior philosophies, which that's Ernst Röhm in the essay. They were just like that. They were the ones that founded old Nazi Party. They were fucking leather daddies. Conveniently erased from history, but look it up. Ernst Röhm, bad motherfucker. He was a World War I hero, all battle scarred, and he was just predatory. That was a men's rights organization, is what they called it. And that was a euphemism for leather daddies.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The director, David Fincher, which I thought this was very interesting, he called Fight Club a coming-of-age film like The Graduate, but for Gen X.
Yeah.
And he says the character, the narrator, who, like I said, is not named, Fincher says he's tried to do everything he was taught to do, tried to fit into the world by becoming the thing he isn't. He cannot find happiness, so he travels on a path to enlightenment in which he must kill his parents, God, and teacher.
Yeah.
So his parents are dead at the beginning. I guess he says, his mom is dead and his dad, took off when he was six or whatever.
Killing God, more Nietzsche.
Yeah, and then killing his teacher in the end. So, metaphorically killing Brad Pitt, that part of him that taught him, his sensei or whatever.
Yeah.
And David Fincher argues that that's how he had to complete his self-actualization by killing his teacher.
Wasn't there a Nietzsche quote about becoming a dragon? If you chase a dragon too long, you become...
Or something like that.
Yes, there's a Nietzsche quote.
I don't remember if it's in the movie, but...
Somebody says something that equates to that, I think, in a movie that we saw recently, and it might have been in this movie. Because sometimes we'll see two of them in a day.
Yeah, I don't remember it being in this movie, but it might be. Okay. I mean, you know what I mean? We did actually have the... Because this is actually the second or third time I've seen this.
Yeah.
Like I said, this is one of those great movies where... Watching it a second time, knowing the twist,
yeah.
It's way, way better because now you can kind of see all the... There's, like, all these little Easter eggs in this, too, where, you know, the first half of the movie, which is very, like, talking about how consumerist and how everything is, like, taken over everything.
Yeah.
In the background frame of, like, almost every shot is a Starbucks cup.
Yeah.
And they just, like, stick them in the back, like, all the time. Because he's trying to, like, make a statement about the, like, ubiquity of, like, these massive brands and everything like that. Yeah. So, but he did it, like, in sort of a subtle
sort of way. Before I forget, so to answer anybody else's questions, when I was talking about Nietzsche was saying it's better to go out and fuck basically a kamikaze attack than to live as a slave or to live in a defeated state. Some people might be like, well, what kind of life is that? That's, you know, how is that life affirming? Well, in this thinking... You're going to die anyway. You're going to die eventually from old age. You might be 20 or 30, might be 40. You might be only giving up 10 years of your life. And this sacrifice is supposed to be honored by your cult. It's a human sacrifice. And it's to allow other things to live. That's the idea. You're getting rid of something that's bad, something that's oppressive, and when it's gone, it will allow other things to rise up out of the fucking morass of life, you know, because that's the Nietzsche kind of looked at. It's kind of like the Force out of Star Wars. Out of the fucking swamp of life, great things sometimes come, you know, and you have to allow it to. You have to allow these things to come into being so the cycle can roll forward, and that. We may or may not live in an afterlife afterwards. It doesn't matter. You know, I think Nietzsche would say we probably don't. But maybe our soul or our energy might be converted into something else that he would call the will. And that's this movie is about will. It's about willpower. And will.
And
Nietzsche's version of will.
The thing about it is that, as I said, I think they, because when it first came out in 1999 and the studio executives didn't really know how to market it, and so they said, well, we'll just focus on the fighting because that's violence and they know that'll bring in like a male audience.
Yeah.
Even though, interestingly, the original audience for it that they polled was about 60-40, male, female. Mostly young, obviously, because this is more of a young person's movie, I suppose, back in 1999. But... That's what I meant, though, when I said that even though they focus very much on the fighting and the violence, and that is a part of the movie, that's not really... I mean, they're not fighting for anything. They're just fighting because they don't feel anything, and they need to feel something, and they're trying to learn to kind of maybe tap back into their savagery or tap back into a thing where... you know, they can get past their pain or they can so they are like no longer afraid of pain anymore.
What they're talking about is they're saying people who are normal consumers live comfortable lives under capitalism. They don't suffer. They buy their way out of suffering for the most part. You get soft by doing that and you get distant from nature, from the cycle of life and death, I guess you could say. Kind of insulating you. There's a pain pleasure principle in people. They move towards pleasure and away from pain, and capitalism encourages that. So in his little training system, he gets them to fight to each other. And if you've ever been in a fight, your first fight, you're kind of scared of getting hit in the face. You get hit in the face, and if you're not knocked out immediately, you realize that it doesn't really hurt, so your fear of the fight goes away, so you start fighting harder. I know whether I'm going to win or lose the first time a dude hits me in the face. If I'm not knocked out immediately, then I know I'm probably going to whip his ass. Because if he was any good, he would have knocked me out in a single blow. You know? And the fear of the pain goes away because you're numb after the first hit hits you. It's like shaking a camera. You might black out for a second or see stars. And then after that, you don't feel any pain at all or any fear. You just double, triple, quadruple down into it. And that's getting into that animal fight or flight response. You go into fight. That's what this movie's talking about. And they're developing that into people to move away from pleasure and towards pain. You'll have strength and you'll be able to sacrifice yourself later on And then you're getting into the brotherhood of people who are like that. It's like you become a different species of man. That's what the movie's talking about.
Well, and I was going to say, too, that it doesn't even necessarily have to be fighting, but it's just like anything. That is... that makes you afraid.
Yeah.
That's why even like if you have phobias and stuff like that, one of the things they try to do is make you, you know, face that all the time, like do it. So, because the fear of it is oftentimes like worse than the actual thing.
Well, he'd go over and drive into the oncoming lanes and the dudes in the back seats would just tolerate it because you're either going to die or not. You're just resigned.
Yeah.
They're trying to overcome the fear of death because your death would be inconsequential anyway. You're going to die. You will die eventually anyway of old age or disease. So what difference does it make? They don't have anything. They're in a warrior cult. Their whole identity is to build up the resistance to fear and pain, to become almost kind of like superhuman. That's what they're doing.
Interestingly, I found this kind of interesting. I don't think necessarily Brad Pitt was the first choice for that role. I think it was supposed to be, what's that motherfucker's name? Russell Crowe?
Yeah.
Which... yeah, maybe.
Yeah, he can do it too.
He's crazy. Russell Crowe was,
yeah, he's fucking crazy.
That probably would have worked. But
throwing
honestly,
phones at plane people, foam throwing bitch.
But honestly,
I'd love to have him throw a phone at me. Crowe, throw the phone, bro.
He'd probably get sick of everybody asking.
Yeah,
him to
probably.
Throw a phone at
I ain't throwing a fucking phone at you, you know.
Although if you asked him enough times, he'd probably just get mad at
fuck you. Anyway. Yeah, throw the phone. Yeah.
Well, I think it would have been a different movie. Honestly, though, I think I'm glad they went with Brad Pitt because honestly, this is one of my favorite performances of his, if not my favorite performance of his. He's great in this.
Yeah, he's great in it. He's a perfect match for it. He's very slick, good looking, real cut, and he just seems like a lunatic. And then there's like he also did good in 12 Monkeys. He did get good.
Yeah,
similar to that kind of guy, a little more held together.
Yeah, I mean 12 Monkeys, he was like
real
full on
shit crazy.
Loon, but
it's a great role. He did a great job in it. But you have to remember, you're watching this shit. They're doing shit. You're like, why are they risking so much over so little? This is a spiritual journey for them. They're reaching what some Buddhists would probably call enlightened indifference, to where they know that they could die, but they're just letting it go. So what? It doesn't matter if we live or die. Which, that's what you have to be like that to be a damn kamikaze. That's basically what we're talking about, being a kamikaze. Certain advantages to being a kamikaze: you can't threaten a kamikaze. They tried to threaten this dude at his job, and he out-kamikazed the fucking boss. And then boss was his bitch, had to pay him for the rest of his life.
Yeah.
So,
which again was kind of like tied back into what I was saying before about, you know, critiquing the consumerist culture, but then becoming that.
Yeah.
Because at the end of the film, the fight clubs have become quote unquote franchised.
Yeah.
And the fact that he essentially bribed his boss or terrorized his boss into just giving him checks for not showing up.
Yeah.
He's like, oh, we now have corporate sponsorship.
Yeah.
So
that didn't weaken it. That strengthened it. Because now they were everywhere. He had a massive army. After that.
That's how he ended up finding out that he was actually Tyler Durden.
Yeah.
Because he was going looking for Tyler Durden, who abandoned him, just like his dad did. They were kind of like playing with that. And then people were like recognizing him and calling him by that name, and he didn't know what the fuck was going on.
People like to pretend that they can achieve moral superiority over an oppressive force. Ah, no. The reason why the force is oppressing you is because it's better than you. It's using techniques and it has strengths that you don't have, and it's using those against you. The only way to beat it is to get those same strengths and take it away. So you are the one with the swords and the axes and the banks and the money, and that's what he did. You can't do it any other way. And that's Nietzsche, too. Stop trying to moralize the shit. Just use what works. The reason why you're being oppressed is because there's an enemy using something against you that works. And that's what you need. That's the tool that you need. Same thing as with conventional armies. If you live in a regular country, they tell you this is all this asymmetrical warfare, that's all terrorism. Well, that's what they do, though. We hire terrorists and send them to other countries. All right. Things that conventional forces that I did when I was in the army, things like wearing camouflage. Back in the 1700s, that'd be considered terrorism. You were supposed to wear a red suit or a blue suit or something white that you could aim at, that you could see, because it's not fair to hide. Only a coward would hide. So everything, all modern forms of warfare are terrorism from the point of view of the generation of warfare that came before it. And that's what they did. That's what this movie's also talking about, that too.
I will note too that the author of the novel, Chuck Palahniuk, who is actually, like, I've actually really liked a lot of his books. I liked Haunted. I liked Lullaby.
Yeah.
This one's great too. Like I said, this is the first one. And interestingly, like I said, the ending is different. But Chuck Palahniuk really, really liked this movie adaptation. He thought it was fucking great. Now, one thing that David Fincher did say, though, is that one of the reasons he changed, he changed the ending, sort of, but he said that he thought that in the book, it was too, he said that the novel was too, quote-unquote, infatuated with Tyler. And his quote was, "I wanted people to love Tyler, but I also wanted them to be okay with his vanquishing." That's what he said about the end of the movie and maybe why he changed it. I haven't read the book in a long time, so I can't remember exactly what happened at the end, but I do remember that the narrator did end up in an insane asylum. So it wasn't quite... I don't know if I'd call the movie, like, the end of the movie, like, a happy ending or an uplifting ending. I guess it depends on your perspective on it, like, how you look at it.
He won, but at a heavy price.
Yeah. And like I said, he did seem to achieve some kind of balance or some kind of peace with himself. You know, by sort of like into vanquishing his teacher, if you want to call it that way, or like I said, there's a lot of different interpretations of it.
Well, when the banks fell, it reduced not only him to zero, everybody else in the world was zero. Remember?
Yeah.
Because all the debts were forgiven. So everybody was starting out equally.
Yeah.
So his self-sacrifice actually equalized a lot of other, you know, millions of other people. So his sacrifice didn't happen in vain.
Yeah.
So it's the thinking of the broader picture of the movie, of his personal war of liberation. Now, is the liberation permanent? No, it's part of a cycle. The competition restarts again. The rich people start to arise. Then they go down the same path he went down, except in the economic realm. And then they become rich people and oppressive again, because they own banks and corporations, or banks and corporations start, you know, becoming oppressive in governments. It's just part of the cycle.
I mean, the more I think about this movie, the more I'm just kind of like, well, you can't win, so you might as well just kind of like chill out and and like what you like and just try to eke some happiness out of life, because you can't fucking win.
No, because it's a cycle.
Yeah, no matter what you do, it's just going to end up in the same
place. Yeah, it'll end up exactly where it's...
sounds depressing, but not really.
It frees you.
It frees you because
now you do not have moral impetus to try to correct things in the way that maybe like Christian morality would tell you to do it. Because you could correct it, but then it wouldn't be corrected for long. It would just go back to the way it was. It reverts to the mean.
Yeah.
You know? You can only do things on a small scale between people that you know. You might be able to help that person. You might be able to help people in your family. You might be able to help people in your local community. But you can't really do it on a global scale, you know? It doesn't work that way. Everybody has different desires that conflict with that. You help that person, well, shit, that person might be an enemy of somebody else. They don't want you helping their enemy. It's that kind of stuff.
And honestly, most people's resources are pretty limited.
They're limited.
It's not like, you know, I'm not a billionaire. I couldn't, like, you know, feed a whole country of people if I wanted to. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. So this movie here, on the Tom Ross scale, I'll put this as a masterpiece up there. Very similar to me with The Art of Self-Defense.
I thought you would find that comparison.
Yeah, very similar.
Because I was kind of thinking that while we were watching it. Because, like I said, I was amazed you had never seen it.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, this is such a fucking classic.
Yeah.
And like I said, it's one of those ones that it seemed like it came out maybe a little too early. Maybe people just weren't ready for it, or they didn't really know what to make of it at the time. But then over time, now it's just kind of like everybody.
Yeah.
I feel like everybody in the world has seen this fucking movie.
Fight Club is the alpha's vision of the problems of life and reality. And then Art of Self-Defense is more kind of like from the beta's point of view. But they're equally true. A lot of things, just like Obi-Wan said, many of the things that we believe in depend upon a certain point of view. But both those movies are essentially true, but they're from two different viewpoints. I like them both.
Yeah.
And the dude that wrote Art of Self-Defense, he's beta. You know what I mean? But he was right, very right, about a lot of that stuff. You know, the warrior cultism, that a lot of it is fucking fake. The fake, in a certain way, fake, that there was a lot of cheating involved. And it wasn't as natural as you'd think. It can go both ways, you know?
Yeah.
It could go both ways, yeah.
So, yeah, so, like I said, pretty much everybody watching this, I'm sure you guys have seen Fight Club. What did you guys think of it? What is your interpretation of it? Please tell me down in the comments. Let's have a discussion. I love this movie. I mean, I have yet to see a David Fincher movie that I didn't like, except maybe Alien 3, but that was his first one. Give him a break. But everything else that I've seen of his is just... I mean, he is just a masterful filmmaker. Every frame of this...
Yeah.
Is just in service to...
I didn't see anything about
the greater theme.
The way it looks is great. It's got a great fucking score. The edit is fantastic. It's a great piece of cinema. Philosophically, it's instructional value. It's educational value. One of the best movies ever made. One of the best movies ever made in terms of what you can learn from it.
See, now I'm glad that that you finally got to see this.
Oh, yeah.
I'm, like I said, I'm surprised.
One of the best movies ever made.
Yeah, okay. Well, that's awesome that
I'd say top five.
I figured you were going to like it.
Yeah.
Just because I hadn't seen it in a long time, but I remembered enough about it that I said, oh, he'll probably love this movie, and I'm amazed that he hadn't seen it yet.
I'm not talking about action movies, you know, Predator, Alien 2. I'm just talking about in terms of just movie, what you can learn from this one, man. In the top five.
I mean, easily. Any movie that inspires this much debate and, you know, kind of, that has, like, whole papers written about it, I mean, you know, you can't really argue with that, can you?
Yeah, it's like there were damn Apocalypse Now, everything, you know, just
got
a lot of good.
Now that you mention it.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, all right, Fight Club, you guys. Yeah. So, that'll do it for this movie retrospective. We will see you guys on the next one. Bye.